Hi, this is Glenn Rawson. One of the most powerful ways to share history and heritage is by the telling of stories. We began sharing inspiring stories nearly 30 years ago. Each of those stories is true and was intended to inspire and strengthen faith. Over the years, those stories have reached millions around the world. This podcast is for you to listen, learn, and enjoy.
Brothers and sisters, good evening. I'm excited about what we're going to talk about. Way back when I was a classroom teacher, I focused, as I've mentioned before, on teaching scripture. And then when I went to work on the Joseph Smith Papers television show, along with Dennis and others, I was immediately thrown into the idea of history. And once we had finished two seasons of the Joseph Smith Papers, we went to work on History of the Saints, the television series. And all of a sudden, our topic was the Pioneer Trail. And I remember a statement made by Michael Landon. I can only paraphrase it now, but he said, "I believe that there are many members of the church who care as much about what happened on the Pioneer Trail as they care about anything in church history." And I thought that was a bit of an overblown statement. But it didn't take long before I learned that in some respects, he was right. The Pioneer Trail is an engaging and fascinating story. And over the next few firesides, I want to talk about it, and I hope to explode a few myths, share stories about ancestors through the month of July, and hopefully give you a better understanding of what that trail means. But speaking for Dennis and myself, we are both fully dyed-in-the-wool rut nuts. And that's a term that means someone who just loves to see old ruts on the Pioneer Trail. Been out there many times and really love the experience. So with that, let me get into it. Now, the background on the trail. With the death of the prophet in June of 1844, Joseph had charged Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve with three great responsibilities. And that was finish the temple, endow the saints, and take the church west. It's a clearly established principle or historical fact that Joseph had taught that the saints would eventually settle in the Rocky Mountains. Well, Brigham Young and the 12 were determined to take the church west. Between the summer of 44 and late fall of 1845, they worked diligently to finish the temple. In fact, they began to perform the endowments in the temple even before the lower stories were finished. But by the time Brigham Young left, or the main body of the saints left in the spring of 46, and in fact, more than 5,600 live endowments were done in the Nauvoo Temple. So the saints were intent on going west. But where? The Rocky Mountains, as most of you can appreciate, is a very vast area. And so in the fall of 45 and the early winter months of 46, there was much talk and discussion about where should we go. They studied the journals and talked to mountain men and trappers, everyone that they could get their hands on who would give them more information. The publications of the explorer, John C. Fremont, which I believe was 1845 when that was published, they studied that. By the time Brigham Young and the saints were ready to go west, they had come to a conclusion, or at least that was solidified in their mind as they crossed the plains. There were three valleys where they thought they might wind up, but they didn't know for sure. The Great Basin or the Salt Lake Valley. And in the Great Basin, the Salt Lake Valley, Utah Valley, and then there was another valley, verdant, cold, far to the north, we now know today as Cache Valley. They thought it might be one of those three valleys, but when they left, no one knew for sure. Brigham Young, sometime during that time when they were working so diligently to endow the saints, Brigham Young lived in the top story of the temple, stayed in an apartment. One night, he experienced a dream. And in that dream, this is described to me as by the scholar and historian Ron Walker, who's since passed away. One night in the dreams of the night, Brother Brigham was visited by the prophet Joseph Smith. And he saw the prophet standing on a small knoll, a small mountain, if you will, with a larger range of mountains behind him. And the prophet Joseph pointed down off of the knoll and said, "Build your temple here," I'm paraphrasing, "and you will prosper." He never said where the mountain was, at least according to the historical record. No one knew exactly where that was supposed to be. Well, persecution in Hancock County, Illinois, did not end with the death of the prophet Joseph and Hiram. There was a lull for a time, but when the temple continued to rise and more Latter-day Saints kept pouring in, it became evident to the enemies of the church that the Mormons were not leaving, and therefore we had to help them. So persecution was stepped up. Haystacks were burned and outlying farms were destroyed. In fact, some of you have mentioned that you are descendants of Edmund Durfee. Edmund Durfee was one of those who was murdered by the mob during those persecutions in 45. Many of the saints were persecuted and driven out and went to Nauvoo to seek asylum and shelter. Well, Brigham Young promised that the saints would leave in the spring of 46. As I've mentioned to you before, the promise was, we'll leave in the spring when the grass grows and the water flows. Water for the stock to drink, grass growing for the stock to eat. Well, in between the fall of 45 and the winter of 45 and 46, Nauvoo became one great hub of preparation and activity. Some of you mentioned about your ancestors who were wagon makers, and I've read several accounts of it. Among those, Charles Shumway, who I'll talk more about in a few minutes. Wagon building became the great occupation, the great trade in demand in late Nauvoo. But then we now come to late January, early February of 1846. Mind you, the saints had been warned, get ready, we're leaving in the spring. I don't remember all of the historical details. There's some machinations going on behind the scenes, but supposedly rumor reached Nauvoo via Governor Ford, who would later admit to spreading the false rumor that the federal government was coming into Nauvoo with troops to prevent the saints from leaving to go west. Suddenly, the church is in an awful predicament. The state of Illinois and the citizens of Hancock County are saying, get out, leave or die. And the federal government is bringing in troops and saying, if you leave, you die, you stay. What are the saints supposed to do? So virtually overnight, President Young stood up in a conference, in a meeting, and said, the saints are leaving. We're going. And on the 4th of February, 1846, Charles Shumway, later stories I'll tell you, described as a man as close to fearless as any man alive, a man who would do anything for the prophets. Charles Shumway, wagon maker and faithful saint in 70, crossed the river. Now, one of the great myths is that all of the saints at this time crossed the river on the ice. No, I'm sorry, that's not true. I'll describe that more in just a few minutes. Charles Shumway and his team of scouts and their wagons ferried their wagons across to the Iowa side. On the 15th of February, Brigham Young and other members of the 12 crossed the river and started west. They went 7 miles into Iowa territory to a place called Sugar Creek. And all of a sudden, when word spread through Nauvoo that the 12 were leaving, suddenly the saints rose up and said, well, wait a minute, we're not ready yet. And without adequate supplies, food, shelter even, without anything, the saints began helter-skelter, willy-nilly, crossing the river to follow Brigham Young into Iowa territory. Brigham would be absolutely frustrated with the Saints. One, because they hadn't listened and prepared. And number two, and he would say it, and I'm paraphrasing, but pretty close to a quote, he would say, "You are raising your prayers to heaven. Brother Brigham, don't leave me. Lord, don't let them go without me." And he said, "All the devils of hell are applauding your prayers," because he said, "You are effectively slowing down the entire operation." And Brigham would go on to explain, "Look, we're not leaving you." And this was Brigham's plan. And I step away from Brigham for a minute, but this was the plan. They would leave in the 1st of February. The plan was to be across Iowa Territory to the Missouri River, what is today Council Bluffs or Florence, Nebraska, or Omaha, Nebraska today. They would go all the way across to the Missouri River and arrive within 6 weeks. That puts them what? End of March, 1st of April. They would resupply, recruit their teams, and by the 1st of June, they would set out for the Rocky Mountains. Brigham Young would lead a vanguard company across the plains and find the Saints' new home, planting crops and building way stations as they went across. And then Brigham said, "And then we'll come back and get the rest of you." But the Saints said, "You're not going without me." And off they went. Before long, there were several thousand people camped at Sugar Creek. It was a mess. People were running back and forth between Sugar Creek and Nauvoo. "Oh, I think I forgot my computer." And back they would go to get this, or back they would go, and back and forth they went. Finally, right at, I believe it was the 1st of March, Brigham Young reorganized the camp and set out across Iowa. From March 1st to about the middle of June, somewhere between 7 and 12,000 Latter-day Saints started across Iowa. Diary accounts describe that when you got out on the trail in Iowa Territory, there were wagons for as far as you could see, all Latter-day Saint refugees fleeing. Well, let me share a few stories of some of the individuals that were there. This lady I talked about once before, but that was so long ago that, well, I think I forgot that I did. I'm going to tell the story about her again. Louisa Barnes Pratt was living in Nauvoo at the time the call for the Exodus came. And she had a small family, but her husband, Addison Pratt, was serving in the South Pacific as a missionary. And when the call came to go west, Louisa was a little bit indignant. She went to one of the leaders, Almon Babbitt, and she said, and I quote, "I asked him if he could divine the reason why those who had sent my husband to the ends of the earth," South Pacific, she's saying, "did not call to inquire whether I could prepare myself for such a perilous journey or if I wished to go or stay." Almon Babbitt's reply was a classic. He said, "Sister Pratt, they," meaning the 12, "they expect you to be smart enough to go yourself without help and even assist others." Now, there are some people you can talk to like that, and there are some people you better not. I'm not sure which one this was, because Sister Pratt wrote in her journal, "The remark awakened in me a spirit of self-reliance, and I replied, 'Well, I will show them what I can do,'" she said. And she did, quoting, "I nerved up my heart and put all my energies to the test to get ready, determined to follow the church, come life or death." Oh, I love that. That's not the end of this. There's more. Well, those words were not just hyperbole, because it almost came to death. As they crossed the mud of Iowa, she wrote, "Yesterday, we traveled the most intolerable roads." And yet, Louisa chose not to look at the mud. In the next journal entry, the next day, she wrote, "I begin now to admire the country, such a beautiful, rolling prairie. Iowa was my mission field. I served there 82 and 83. I was one of those 18-month missionaries, and Iowa is, for flatland prairie country, it is gorgeous country. Now, I'll continue her story in a moment, but that begs a point to be shared. First of all, they set out with the intent to reach the Missouri River in 6 weeks. But while they were camped there at Sugar Creek, the temperatures were relatively warm. But right around the 22nd or 24th of February, 1846, the temperatures dropped to minus 12 degrees, 12 below zero. Can you imagine? We talk about the sufferings of the handcart people, and indeed, they did. But the first sufferings of our pioneer fathers on the trail came in those days in Iowa when the temperatures dropped so fast and so far. John Taylor describes that all he could create for shelter, and this is a member of the 12 who's prepared. The 12 gave away all their provisions to take care of all the saints who were not ready. He describes throwing a blanket over a low-hanging branch and bedding his family down in that sub-zero weather. I can't even imagine what it would have been like. It's at that time, in the end of February, when the temperatures dropped so low that the river froze solid, and some of the immigrants coming out of Nauvoo did indeed cross their wagons on the ice. Someone sent me just a day or two ago a comment about their ancestor, who was the one whose wagon went out first to test the ice. Unfortunately, I've got that kind of memory where I can hide my own Easter eggs. I can't remember which pioneer it was, but maybe you'll remind me. So it was that short window right there where pioneers were able to cross on the ice, but most of them had to ferry across. Well, no sooner did they leave and get out onto the prairies of Iowa when the temperatures warmed up and it began to rain. And it turned the roads across Iowa into this sloppy, sticky, gumbo mud. Instead of making 15 miles a day with their ox teams and wagons, sometimes they were lucky to get one because of the difficulty. President Brigham Young was the hero of the hour because as he was leaving Nauvoo, and we have diary accounts of the saints standing on the bluffs on the west side, looking back at Nauvoo, Lewis Barney, Newell Whitney, and others looking back at Nauvoo with heavy hearts and lamentations, looking at that beautiful temple that they're leaving behind. But Brother Brigham had an altogether different spirit about him. He said, "Nauvoo, to me, is a prison house. Now," he said, "out in Iowa, I am free. When I look backward," he said, "I see darkness. When I look forward, I see light." And Brother Brigham was the hero of the day. He would later jokingly describe that when he left Nauvoo, he had a coat that he could barely button around his girth. And by the time he'd gotten across Iowa, that coat would lap over because he had lost so much weight. He was everywhere, struggling to pull wagons through the mud, lifting, encouraging, building. It is no exaggeration the term that Brigham Young would become the American Moses. It's no exaggeration when they say, Richard Bennett and others will say, what Joseph Smith started, Brigham Young finished. What Ron Walker used to say, that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were the twin pillars of the Restoration. And for the next few firesides, you will hear me speak in glowing terms about Brigham. Now, mind you, he was not Joseph. Brigham would tell you where the bear sleeps and show you. But he was an effective leader and loved his people. Brigham Young would quip with that crossing of Iowa in all of that mud and slop. He would write in his journal, this is pretty close to a quote, "Went through one mud hole today, 6 miles in length." That's what their Iowa crossing was, and it effectively slowed them down. They struggled through the mud. Sometimes they would have to put as many as 8 oxen on a wagon to drag it through the mud. And all of that is costing them time. Well, Louisa continues. She makes a conscious decision, notwithstanding the difficulty of the march, to be of good cheer. She wrote in her diary, "It comes suddenly to my mind how far I am going from home, parents, and every relative I have in the world. But the Lord has called us and appointed us a place where we can now live in peace and be free." I will tell you more about Louisa Barnes Pratt later. I talked about this dear lady as well, and I know that some of you out there are related to her, and it is a noble posterity. March 12th, 1846. So this is in the lead company. They're right out on the lead, traveling with the 12 in near Keosauqua, Iowa. Catherine Curtis Spencer was very ill, still weak from childbirth and afflicted by a severe cold. Her illness caused her to sink lower and become weaker. For days, it had rained on the prairies of Iowa, making the roads an impassable, miserable mess. What had brought this dear, tender, sweet mother into such a predicament? Catherine Curtis was born and reared in Massachusetts, the youngest daughter of a numerous family, nurtured with fondness and peculiar care as the favorite of her father's house. When she came of age, she married a very unusual man, Orson Spencer, a man of great intellectual and spiritual gifts, a minister. Together, Orson and Catherine had 6 children. Over time, Catherine proved herself the glory of her husband and the joy and solace of her children. They joined the church. Orson gave up his ministry. They immigrated to Nauvoo. They served with great distinction and honor there in Nauvoo. And when the call came to go west, Orson and Catherine were among those who turned their faces to follow the 12. Unbeknownst to Catherine, Orson wrote home to Catherine's parents, asking if Catherine and the children might come home for an extended visit while he went out and served as a missionary. But Catherine's parents, bitterly opposed to the church, wanted nothing to do with it. When the saints went west on the 4th of February, Orson and Catherine went with them. Not far, as I mentioned, into Iowa Territory, temperatures plummeted well below zero. Then it warmed, the roads turned to mud, the roads into quagmire, and in those miserable, soaking wet, cold conditions, Catherine grew weaker and weaker, and finally seemed to sense that she was not going to live. She gathered her children to her, saying, "Oh, you dear little children, how I do hope you may fall into kind hands when I am gone." Then came the letter from Catherine's parents. She asked Orson to read it to her. And in the letter, they refused to allow her to visit or render any aid or comfort until she denounced the religion they so much detested. Having learned what her husband had done, Catherine asked Orson to fetch a Bible. She instructed him to open it up to this passage and asked him to read it. Quote, "Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. Where thou lodgest, I will lodge. For thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part me and thee." Ruth, chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. Not long after, Catherine asked to see each of her children, bid them goodbye, and gave them a parting kiss, turned to her grieving husband and said, quote, "I love you more than ever, but you must let me go. I only want to live for your sake and that of our children." Shortly thereafter,
Catherine Curtis Spencer, died in peace with a smile upon her countenance. She was 35 years old. Orson, in the solitude of the night, took her body back to Nauvoo and buried her by her youngest child. It was said by others in the camp, quoting, "She was a kind mother to her beautiful children, a lady in every respect, and left a beautiful family." Orson Spencer would later become the first president of the University of Deseret, and Catherine's daughter, Aurelia Spencer Rogers, would organize the first children of the primary. We talk at length about martyrs, and our thoughts turn first to the prophet Joseph and Hiram, and well they should. They died martyrs to their faith. They were not the first, and they certainly would not be the last. You see, Dennis and I, along with others, wrote a book on the massacre at Hans Mill. It could well be described, when you know the historical facts, a massacre indeed it was, but Hans Mill was a martyrdom. Catherine Curtis Spencer died a martyr on the plains. I will speak of others as we go through this tonight.
Thank you for listening. Many of the stories you heard today have been published and are archived at glennrossinstories.com. If you would like more information, you can communicate with us there. We will be back again with another podcast next week.